Hi, and welcome to another episode of Rule of Carnage. This is where myself, Glenn Ford, a game designer and developer, chats to this guy, Mike Hutchinson, also a games designer and developer, about designing better miniatures games. So there's one, I think, fairly big subject where, you know, if you watch the channel quite often, we cover like mechanics and rules and things of that nature. And there's one big area that I think we've not touched on that's worth sort of talking about and is very, very important for a game.
Is that whether or not we pluralize miniatures in miniatures games? Okay. I still can't decide.
Surgeons General, yeah. Yes, well, it's the players. I mean, specifically player psychology. And I thought it'd be interesting to have a little chat in this video about player personality types. There's an enormous amount of literature out there on player personality types, and it goes into enormous depth and is very fascinating and worth reading. However, quite a lot of it is about sort of video game player personality types. So there are like some major personality types, like the explorer personality type, that's not impossible to do on the tabletop in a tabletop miniatures game, but incredibly hard and possibly less relevant. And so what I'm gonna sort of frame this around today is the Magic the Gathering player types, also because this is probably something that tabletop gamers might well be familiar with and have heard of before. And these are sort of player personality types that the Magic the Gathering designers sort of pitch cards as being for when they design those cards. The sort of the players will want those cards in their decks or be attracted to by them. And they quite neatly frame, I think, particularly in relation to things like army building, and the attractions to a game, some of the attractions for different personality types for a miniatures game. And so I think they're worth addressing and thinking about, and thinking particularly about how you can attract those player personality types by putting in the things that they look for in your game. So we'll probably have this as two conversations. In the first one, we're going to talk about the three sort of classic original Magic the Gathering personality types. They've been sort of gender neutralized recently, but they're originally Johnny, Timmy, and Spike. So we'll start with, so Johnny is sort of referenced by the Magic the Gathering designers as the complex creative combo player. In more classical terms, I would say that a Johnny player is somebody who plays to express themselves, to express their sort of creativity in designing obviously Magic the Gathering a deck, but in our sorts of games, an army list. These are the people who want to find delicious army lists that are unusual and weird and do strange or interesting things. I mean, I would say, like, of the personality types, I personally most strongly identify with the Johnny personality type myself. A Johnny personality wants to win, but it's very important that they win on their own terms. The choice between getting a win by playing like a Spike character or losing, they'll take losing. Winning at all costs isn't important. It's important that you win by triggering your combo or by doing the interesting thing. You want the other person to, once they've seen you win, go, "Oh yeah, that was very sweet. That was lovely that you did that."
Right. And so, like, Johnny's not interested in taking the obvious route to victory. By extension, if a non-obvious route has become popular and netlisted or whatever, then it's also now not interesting.
Absolutely. That's you know, so we'll talk about Spike in a minute. Netlisting is a Spike thing, and it is like offensive to a Johnny character. The Johnny character in list building is attracted to weak and undervalued options. They love the thing that is officially broken in a negative way, not like it's broken because it's OP, it's like it's broken because you're a lunatic if you try and take this. That's like catnip to your Johnny character. They're like, okay, I have to make that list. I have to change everybody's mind about that thing because you've all agreed that it's complete garbage. One of the things I think about a Johnny personality particularly is that they need guidance. They need lines to press against. They need sort of structures that they constrain themselves against. One of the things I think is super interesting, and I've been finding recently talking to people who obviously, you know, I come across a lot of people with sort of their own designs and various designs, is that a lot of the designs I'm seeing at the moment, weirdly, are falling into one of two categories, to my mind, in relation to the sort of Johnny mindset. One of them is my game is like totally everything agnostic. You have all of the options in the world sort of in a big bucket, and you take out whatever you want from it, and there are no sort of, I'm not going to control you, I'm not going to make you play a certain way or do a certain thing. And another set of them are like, okay, list building is like one of the things that defines a miniatures game. I've heard several people say that weirdly in the last couple of months. It's funny because despite this being the sort of thing that attracts me to games, I definitely don't think miniatures games defined by list building. But those
it's a common design feature at the moment, but I agree with you, it's in no way definitional.
No, it's a trope, it's a major element, but it's not at all a definition of the form. But those the people I've seen doing these designs then have these sort of extremely arcane sort of list building systems with like there's a million different options and decision trees through them that are like everybody's going to bounce off this immediately.
And I just want to make sure to get this point in early. Like, you've mentioned that you identify with this Johnny character, and we'll get on to some of the other members of this crew, but I think one of the most powerful things in understanding and taking the time to think about these things is that, like, I'm a particular kind of player, you're a particular kind of player, we happen to be different kinds of players. It has been part of my journey as a games designer to realize that fact, and to realize that there isn't one true way. Like, my way of approaching things is the best way for me and people like me, but the best game that I can make has a little something for me, a little something for Glenn, and a little something for other people who are interested in other things. So as we're having this conversation, my mind is ticking over going like, yeah, where are the places in my previous designs where I have skipped over providing juicy nuggets of toffee for any one of these in these groups?
Absolutely. And this is one where I think that it's like, it's really handy if you can, particularly if you recognize yourself or one of your friends in one of these personality types.
Right.
Because often I'll write things and I'll think, okay, this is a thing that Mike or someone like Mike is really going to like, because I don't like the things in games that you like. And, you know, I'll often think of a thing or a rule. I'll think, I'll put this in because this will please Mike. And he will smile when he sees this.
Is it a handle that says fireworks and you pull it and it goes?
Well, it's sort of that nature, and we'll talk about the type that I think you fall into more strongly, which is Tim, in a second. But I think so. I think the thing is that for a Johnny type, like, the cardinal sins of design are like excessive looseness, excessive freedom. It's almost like, if you think of somebody who loves like solving mazes, and then you dump them in a field and go, well, you can build any maze you like in this field, I have given you total maze freedom. They just go, well, I'll just walk out the field. I'm not a lunatic. This is completely unsatisfying to me. And I think in relation to a lot of these, as I was sort of researching these, I sort of thought, one of the things about Gaslands, and I know I'd say this because we sort of worked on it, Gaslands hits a lot of these things quite sweetly, and I think it's a large part of why it was such a strong game. And it does have those things in the sponsors, obviously, and the build slots and the way you can put cars together that are very strongly sort of angled towards this sort of gamer and satisfying to them. But I think what's important in relation to something like Gaslands is that it doesn't put off the person who isn't this kind of player. It doesn't say you have to learn this incredibly arcane thing and engage in a meta and all those sorts of things to enjoy this game. It says, look, this thing is here, but it will work just fine if you just load up a car with some missiles and go for it. You won't be heavily disadvantaged, and you won't feel like you're missing out on the real deal of the game. You'll just sort of have chosen not to engage with part of it.
Now, I know you're not following the Warhammer 40,000 new edition very closely. I've dived feet first into it because partly I'm an old 40K fan, and this one looks attractive to me. But partly I like being part of what's going on in the biggest part of the community to see what's going on. Now, specifically related to Johnny. Games Workshop have made a change in the most recent presentation of 10th edition Warhammer 40,000, which I think is really smart for Johnny specifically. So for the last decade or so, there's been three ways to play any Warhammer game. There's been open, which is basically like freeform jazz, just put all your toys on the table, who cares? Like, if you're not having fun, it's your fault, not mine. Then there's narrative, which is let's string the battles together in some kind of scenario-laden, asymmetric story time. And then there's, you know, matched play, like competitive sort of skewed, you know, good for pickups and that or not. And they've reset that. And in the new version, they've got three versions. They basically kept matched play and narrative, but they swapped out the first one for this thing called Combat Patrol, which is basically you buy a box of models and it comes with enough rules to get stuck into the game quickly. And that's good for a couple of reasons. One is it's good for introducing people to the player, to the game, because it provides them with no list building. But it's a no list building version that still works for Johnny, because Johnny can pick one of a number of boxes which are considered to be junk, and he gets enough options in there to prove that, haha, if you do use the space elves correctly, then actually you can win even in this funny little game mode. I think that removing the open play way to play, the canonical way to play, is actually a really smart choice, because open play was a really mono-directed play mode that only pointed at a subset of their player base, whereas what they've replaced it with is actually much more viable for all of the player types that we're talking about. And so I think that's interesting, because obviously they're a big company who are doing more research than most of us.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, actually, because we were having a chat the other day about 10th edition, and you were saying about how, like, previously you've repeatedly got annoyed by the merry-go-round of like army books and codexes coming out from GW, and then you re-get it and you go like, oh, I have to sort of figure out, well, great, now my favorite miniature is garbage again. And one of the things I want to say, I said to you at the time, what's interesting is that for the players like me, that's getting to re-engage with the bit of the hobby that we love. It's like, that's not a sort of, oh, this again. It's like,
right, so quite really? Specific, yeah, so quite specifically what I was saying was, like, there's a thing in 10th edition now where you buy a squad, and regardless of what the weapon options it's got, they're all free. You can just choose whether you have plasma pistols or bolt pistols or like cardboard, you know, cutouts of people, and they all cost the same amount. So obviously one of them is the optimal choice. And so if you built the models under the old edition, because you were like, well, the optimal choice is to not spend two extra points per model on plasma pistols, you're now an idiot, because you may as well. And so now you have to rebuild your force. But what you were saying is, like, when I play an army for a few years and then a new set of rules comes along and invalidates that army, it's like, ooh, a wonderful challenge has been thrown down for me to re-engage with the crunchiest part of this trifle.
Yeah. Well, it's like, okay, I've built my list. Then I spend the next sort of year or two proving that list is what I thought it was going to be, and proving my point by playing it through and expressing myself by this thing that I found. Now I would like to redo that, please. You know, I've made my point. It's time to move on. Talking about time to move on. So, okay, the second personality type, and this is the one that I always feel sort of is the Mike sort of personality type, if any of them singly are, is one they call Timmy, So in Magic the Gathering, Timmy is the player who is obsessed with putting down a big creature, like a big single card, and then seeing it absolutely whang somebody in the face and like smash them off the board. And they always put it down, and then somebody drops a 2-point kill spell and then immediately knocks them off. And, you know, Timmy doesn't really care because Timmy got to put down his big creature and we all got to see the big creature and all that. Timmy plays to experience. They're a much more social gamer. They're interested in things that say they're powerful on the box, say that they're fireworks factories. They're interested in trying out lots of different options. They're much more interested in sort of diversity. They don't want to focus on one thing and perfect it. They want to get as many of the toys out of the box as they possibly can. They are sort of a little bit more adrenaline driven sometimes than other players. They are also, if there are some, they are, because of their social nature, people most likely to be sort of griefers in gaming. They're the people who want to get a reaction out of you, and at best that means they want to share the game with you and they want you to sort of have this sort of experience between the two of you. But as long as they get a reaction out of you, that's kind of one of the most important things. And it's this thing of like playing to experience. They're the spectacle makers. They want a big boom to occur on the tabletop. You know, again, they're sort of their cardinal sin, and it's very much one of Mike's sort of great sort of game design mantras, is to avoid moments of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The worst possible outcome is that nothing occurs. They don't mind getting absolutely destroyed on the tabletop, so long as something really, really happened and stuff went on. So long as they didn't lose by non-moments occurring repeatedly, that's all they really care about. And ideally that they can then say to the other person, wow, did you see that? If it was, wow, did you just see how my unit got absolutely obliterated by that hellstorm of rocket fire coming in? That's fine with them. That's okay. So long as they can go, hey, we really experienced a thing there together, didn't we? That was super fun and exciting.
So Timmy plays orcs in Warhammer 40,000, does he?
Yes, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's they want the Gigantosaurus Rex in Magic. You know, they want orcs in Warhammer. They want things to blow up. They want an experience to occur. And obviously, referencing back to Gaslands, I think, you know, it's pretty clear to a lot of people where the Timmy moments are in Gaslands. The wipeout flip explosion, the fact that you so often win a race upside down and on fire, are like super Timmy things. They're super like, I don't care.
Right, like the whole of the sixth gear is just for him. apart from when Johnny's proving that he doesn't need to turn because he can just spins.
spins are the best way to steer. Well, just the very idea that one of the core sort of concepts of Gaslands is you blow up and you think it was funny. You enjoy yourself getting, you enjoy your stuff getting destroyed, is an inherent sort of way you can play Gaslands. And not as a power move, but just as a, because it was just brilliant and everyone got involved. And then you get the chain reaction thing where I flip and blow up and that causes you to wipe out and flip and you land on him when you flip and then you blow up. And that's like the whole sort of wipeout explosion chain reaction phenomena in Gaslands is the most sort of Timmy thing you'll ever come across in a game, because it doesn't matter how you built your lists, that thing is going to happen at some point, and it's going to appear to be a mad chain reaction, although it will happen a lot more often than you might suspect. And everyone got involved, everyone at the table had some, you know, level of effect on it, and it's a very shared experience that's sort of very important to that sort of gamer type. And I think, yeah, as I say, I often think of things, I don't think of things when I'm designing to be like, you know, is it a play to experience moment, is it a Timmy moment. I think, you know, will this make Mike smile when I write those rules in a game and those moments in a game.
And with that, we'll take a quick break.
So just to summarize before we move on, so Johnny, you got to make sure that there are non-obvious ways to win. And for Timmy, you got to make sure that there are as few moments of nothingness as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to give Johnny this thing where they can express themselves by finding something other people haven't found. That's what's really important, I think. I think it's like
hidden treasures.
Usually, if I go to a club and a few other people are playing a game that I haven't picked up yet and I'm interested in it, my first question is always, which faction is nobody else playing?
Mm.
That is what's instantly attractive. And if everyone's playing one of the factions, are they going to find one and find the master that nobody else is using?
Now, there's another form of expressing yourself, which I guess we will get onto. But there's like the other reason for asking that question is because you want to demonstrate yourself like artistically, or you want to fit into, you know, to complete the pantheon. You want to be. It's more like a. There's almost like a socializing aspect there. It's like, well, what are you missing to make this world richer for everyone? Well, I'll go play those guys, because if no one's playing Tomb Kings, like, I'll bring the Tomb Kings. That'll be amazing.
Yeah, and that fits in a little bit with one of the player character types we'll talk about in the next conversation. And it has to be said, these are an incomplete picture, because they are taken from Magic the Gathering. They're much more about, like, particularly these three are more about the list building process and some of the mechanics. And because there aren't really like a definitive set of these versions of player types for miniatures, you know, tabletop gaming. Nobody happens to have like written a book on this. You know, maybe GW has a version of these player types pinned on a wall somewhere, but they've never like openly released them to everybody else in the way that Magic the Gathering does. And people haven't written like major books focusing on this sort of part of the hobby. So these will be an incomplete picture, and we'll talk about that a bit in the next sort of conversation. And then, yes, I think you're probably the best person to answer what you need to put in for a Timmy, but I think it is like, yeah, make sure that nothing, like, there are no null events, that you roll dice and you're expecting a thing to happen that was going to be fun and then that gets pulled away from you.
Mm.
And the last of those three sort of classic Magic the Gathering personality types is the Spike. Now, Spike is the sort of the classic competitive player. Spike is playing to prove. They're the net listers. They will take anybody else's list. They don't care that it's, you know, somebody else wrote it and somebody else did the sort of, I know, creative thinking or whatever, however you want to think about it. They're about innovating and sort of tinkering and perfecting, analyzing things on a very, very, very close in level and doing tiny, tiny, tiny little, you know, millimeter tweaks. And they're more than happy to turn up. It's, for me, the thing that killed going to tournaments like BGW tournaments was turning up and seeing like a hall of 80 people and there being three lists in the entire hall. That's what a Spike player lives for. They're like, this is fantastic. And this is, they have, I think, to many people's minds, sort of come to dominate like the Magic the Gathering tournament scene, to the point where you get lists, deck lists published, and then like all the top players have one of those three or four lists with like a minor tweak backwards and forwards, to the point where like fans of Magic the Gathering will just say, oh, they have a blah, they have the blah blah deck. And it's like, if you're not familiar with it, you'll go, well, what the hell is a blah blah deck? And it's like, well, that's the one that became dominant in that in the previous two tournaments. You know,
and my headcanon of this player type is that they are most interested in like executing amazingly, like performance at the table is much more important than originality or like ownership in the list creation. So these are people who they're almost like more in the moment than Johnny is, because they are living for that, like that tussle at the table where you're like, well, I've got to pilot this list to success.
Hmm. Yeah. It's they're very much focused on like it is actually about the winning, because it's about proving to everybody that you thought that swapping out this thing, you know, that's 5 points cheaper or more expensive, or tweaking that weapon or adding this unit made the list more efficient. And then you get to prove to everybody that you are right about that. They will have to acknowledge that you're right about, because you just won it. And I've met, like, you know, particular sorts of Spike players at tournaments. It's like I met a chap on one of the top I managed to get to a top table and won the tournament, and the guy next to me was so excited because if he won his next game, his list would be a net list because it would be, he would like have won the tournament. And so from then on, next tournament he would turn up and he would see like 100 clones of his army. And that was like the highest good to him. It was like, oh, that, this is amazing. I'm going to be like the progenitor of one of these things that I love so much. And to me, it'd be like, well, that just means I'd have to burn the list at that point.
Right, right. Yeah.
It'd be like, that would absolutely kill it stone dead.
Is it the difference between wanting to be an A-list celebrity and wanting to be so hipster that no one's even heard of the bands you listen to?
I think it's sort of that. I think
Kurt Cobain was a Johnny because he was like, well, now I'm famous, I have to kill myself.
Well, I think a lot of these things, I think I call the Johnny personality type the sort of the need to express, but I think these are all ultimately about the different ways you want to express yourself.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what I was elbowing at in the earlier comment, is that I think it doesn't feel right to say Johnny plays to express themselves, because I think many of us do. I guess expression in my like, for me, like narrative and sort of social play is a form of expressing yourself as an individual, like playing to win and to demonstrate that, like, in a battle of wits, you know, you come out on top, like, obviously completely legitimate way to express yourself. And that's what I love about this, is that there's no value judgment here. These are all just things you have to deal with, that are, there are humans that compute the world in different ways and will focus on different elements of your game design and will be cross with your game if it leaves them completely cold on the things that they're looking for.
Absolutely. And it's a personal thing for me. It bugs the hell out of me when I see like designers talk about their game and I basically ask some questions that boil down to, well, how is this going to work for a sort of spike personality type? And their response is essentially, I don't care about that personality type. They're not the right kind of player for me. They're not enjoying the game in the right way. And it's like, that's wrong. Everybody, you know, no, there's no right or wrong to any of these personality types. They all want to enjoy your game in their own way, and you can cater to all of them.
Yeah, I had a very, this has happened a lot, but we had a fresh comment somewhere in the Discord over the last couple of weeks where somebody said I think it was about Hobgoblin. They were like, well, I don't see this as being a competitive game. It's more of a beer and pretzels game. And I think there's plenty about both A Billion Suns and Hobgoblin for Spike, insofar as there's a knotty little engine that at the table is a very two-directional, it's a combative environment. The rules are tight and you can definitely best someone at sword point. I think what's interesting is that perhaps the personality that I have, being quite a Timmy player, shines through in the way that I present my games or the way that I design my games or the things that I emphasize. And so perhaps people who are more like me, or there's more of them gravitating to my games, or all sorts of gamers will look at that and sort of naturally begin to filter it through. Because this person wasn't saying anything offensive. They were simply saying, well, I like your game for this reason, and it's not something that I can equate with the competitive mindset. Ergo, it's not a competitive game. Mm. But of course, I'm trying hard to say, well, no, if you take A Billion Suns very seriously and play it like it's some kind of chess match, like, my hope is that you find something there for you, because there's a deeply crispy thing that you can prove that you can definitely outplay Mike at his own game, because you definitely can.
I mean, I think for the Spike player, I think there's one thing that's super important for a Spike player, and there's another thing that's super important for everybody who encounters a Spike player when playing your game. The thing that's super important for a Spike player is that your rules should be clear, frankly. Right. tight clear rules with minimal levels of mediation. And tracking back to Gaslands, the thing about Gaslands I think that makes it work wonderfully for a Spike player is that thing. It is the rule of carnage. Because the rule of carnage says you never need to have anything mediated. You can always predict how the rules will pan out in any given situation. And that's the most important thing, I think, for a Spike player in a sort of miniatures tabletop game that you can predict what will be the outcome of a particular rules interaction in these sorts of games. And I think equally, and it, I think as long as you've got a rule
right, set, because you're not playing, that player is not playing in a like hand-holding way where they take the opposing player's hand across the table and they sweetly tell them in advance all the things they're going to do, which in a narrative game at its height, like you essentially are just doing a kind of collaborative storytelling using miniatures. And that's not what Spike's looking for at all. Like he wants to be able to surprise you, perhaps even gotcha you, but do so within an utterly crisp and defendable way that's like, well, you had all the same information I had, and therefore I played better than you. I outthought you.
100%. And I think the sorts of rules you see sometimes that are, you know, that basically say there will be contradictions in these rules, and the rules won't answer certain questions that come up. When those happen, pick two options and roll a dice. That's quite anathema to the Spike player, because he's like, well, I can't know how the rules work. I cannot pre-plan for that given moment. Genuinely, at one table, it will have been the right decision to do this, and a different table, it would have been the wrong decision to do this because of how that deciding dice roll comes down. And like I say, the rule of carnage is a beautiful rule for Spike, because he goes, well, that's great, because it will always pan out the same at every single table. There is a position that can be made, an argument that could be made, and now I can know. And now, because of that, the whole rule set, although Gaslands is a very beer, is often presented as a very beer and pretzels game, it's a super tight rule set because every single rule has a definitive answer to the outcome to it. It's what makes it very sort of playable as a tight game if you want to, and makes it something that a Spike player can engage with and can go, I never need to have doubt. I never need to wonder. I never need to go through, you know, arguing and then finding out on a dice roll that today the rule that I relied on yesterday isn't true anymore, which is absolutely anathema to them. I think the thing that you need for everybody who isn't a Spike player encountering a Spike player, which is a thing that I talk about again and again, is making sure that winning and having fun are basically doing the same thing. And it constantly baffles me, the number of designers who sort of go, well, I've put the fun thing, everyone will do the fun thing, otherwise they're an awful person. But there's a really unfun way of definitely winning. Won't I do that? Not unless you're terrible. Well, some people are going to do that. Why not just let them meet other people across the tabletop and not end up wanting to rip each other's heads off? Why not just make it so those two things are the same thing? And that's how you allow a competitive player. You know, the very fact that what Timmy...
It's also just part of the basic reward loop of I'm inviting you to do a thing, and therefore I will reward you for doing that thing. And the easiest reward loop that you have is winning the game or giving you victory points.
And it's the thing is, it's like Timmy is sort of often seen as a really the most non-competitive personality type, and all they want to do is see things blow up. Spike is the most competitive personality type. All they want to do is beat you. If beating you means blowing all of your stuff up, then those two people are just going to absolutely love the same exact experience, because Spike's going to blow up all of Timmy's stuff and Timmy's going to laugh at Barorosy as it all blows up. And so there doesn't have to be a clash between those two people. It's just not necessary to not bring them together on the tabletop. You only don't allow those two people to play together when you say to Spike, hey, Spike, the way you win this game is just by walking off the table, doing nothing whatsoever, or pressing this big negate button where every single time that Timmy tries to do something, you pull out a blue negate card and go, no, 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 no fun for you. Are we done yet? We're done now.
Spike's not having fun either at that point.
The thing is, Spike is, because Spike knows that Spike's going to win, and that is the thing that drives him. And he's like, I'm disappointed that you didn't build a thing to make this harder for me. I'm disappointed in you, but I'm happy with my victory. And this thing, you can get these people together. And I think that's the most important point to sort of make in this part of the conversation, is that these people can all play at the same tabletop and can all enjoy the same game. And it's not, to me, it's one of the most upsetting things when I see a designer basically discount one or another of these personality types. Because the classic idea is like that Johnny basically looks down on Timmy as being some sort of naive and looks down on Spike as being sort of non-creative and non-imaginative. And Spike looks down on Johnny for making up rules that don't exist and playing to an imaginary set of rules, and looks down on Timmy for being a
nightmare. Even bothering to try to win.
Yeah, exactly, for not really caring about winning. And Timmy hates both of them for caring more about winning than about having fun or minding how the game comes out. And that none of that is necessary. None of those sort of divide lines are necessary. All those people can enjoy the exact same thing. They have the same interests. You know, they want to show each other what they do. You know, Johnny wants to show Timmy this sort of magical thing that he's done. And like, oh, look at this amazing combo. Wasn't that sweet and delightful? You know, that was an experience, right? And, you know, and Timmy wants to experience a thing that he hasn't seen before. He wants to see the T-Rex on the table, but he's more than happy to see your fireworks factory chain reaction. And Spike wants to be challenged by Johnny and is more than happy to pants Timmy in a way that Timmy finds enjoyable. So just do that. Just make these people enjoy each other. That should be what your design is aiming for.
I guess there's just a couple of other footnotes here. So one is clearly, although these player personas, these player personality types are being talked about as if they are individuals, it's really important to know that like every player contains a mix of these. And I think one of the things that I've observed is that I become more biased to one personality type or another depending on the game that I'm engaged with, and to a degree depending on the community that's built up around the game that I'm engaged with, and vice versa. I think there are games that engender more of a bias in their players towards one of these, by which I mean the people who come in and like the look of the game then sort of naturally drift in one direction or another because of what the game, how the game is presented or what it's telling them. Personally speaking, because when I was playing Malifaux second edition, I was doing it in a community that was quite competitive, and then I got really interested in the social aspect of the tournament scene, and so just played in a way that became, you know, I wasn't clever enough to come up with things, so I just played in a very Spike way, but one that led to a lot of, you know, really enjoyable cerebral experiences followed by extremely enjoyable social experiences. And I don't play almost any other games right now in that way. There are some board and card games I kind of deal with in that way. Oddly enough, I'm happy to steal net lists for things like Arkham Horror, the card game, because I began by thinking, well, I'm kind of a Johnny on this and I want to learn how to make original lists. And then I realized I wanted to sort of perform well as part of a team. And so I was happy to focus on the winning part of it because it was part of a broader social fabric. So I think maybe I'm creating a sort of going off into some of the other things that we'll discuss maybe in the second half of this conversation in a subsequent video. But I just think it's important to know everyone is both a mixture of these and also shifts in their EQ depending on you as a games designer and the community that springs up around your game.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's all very true. And we'll sort of wrap this up in a second. But I think in relation to that, I think one of the things that's interesting when you see like second editions or expansions for games is how a game gets driven by what is perceived to be its primary customer base sometimes, which isn't 100% of its customer base. And sometimes that perception drives it away from the thing that attracted the people to it in the first place. And, you know, and some of these games can sort of lose their footing. It's like I was reading about the ending of Guild Ball, and that basically Guild Ball got killed by, you know, its player base liking what it was doing too much and then responding too much to the player base liking it, which is, that feels like it should be a sort of a perfect a utopian loop, but that it ended up just choking the life out of it.
That seems like a good place to take a quick break.
So we covered Johnny, who is also known as Glenn on this channel, who plays to express themselves by inventing bizarre combos and coming up with crazy ways to win that no one else has seen. We talked about Timmy, also known as Mike on this channel, who likes to put a large dragon on the table and then gets cross when you shoot it off before it gets to do its one breath attack and kill a unit. But if it kills a unit and then it gets killed, that's all fine, because that Timmy plays to experience. And then we talked about Spike, which is probably the most contentious of these initial personality types, which is the player who just bloody loves winning and proving that they can win, and doing so in a way that is completely defendably within the rules, and showing you exactly how the rules can best be utilized to demonstrate that winning is great and that they are the best at winning. And we talked about how to engender positive interactions between those guys. So go and listen to that other conversation that I've now summarized. But there are some more that Magic the Gathering introduced more recently.
Mm.
Glenn, did they put them on a separate axis where, like, one of them's about the game and the other one's about how they get into the game versus play the game or something?
So the first three are about are meant to be about what cards those players want to put into the deck that they build.
Okay, so we can talk about them as like list building personas, like what do you choose to put on the table in Miniatures War Game?
The other two sort of additional personalities they dropped in a little more recently are about the sorts of cards that will attract these people to the game, as it were. Oh, the overall they like. They might not want to use that card, but they will enjoy the idea of it or the theory of it. And they might also then put it into a deck, but primarily they just like that card's very being in many ways.
Right. And a Magic the Gathering card in this conversation, I'm going to equate to sort of either as an indie games designer, it's like an indie game will attract you for a couple of different reasons, or for one of the big like expanded games, like a faction or a new army book or whatever will attract you because of this. So that's kind of where I'm imagining a Magic the Gathering card sort of nets out here.
It's a degree of that. I think it's also to a degree sort of what the hook is for a certain game sometimes.
Yeah.
Like a certain, so we'll talk about Melvin in a second, and Melvin, you know, would be hooked by a particular mechanic in a game, and I'm right. In that respect, I'm quite a Melvin-y player, where I see a particular mechanic just and I'm like, okay, I've got to play that game because I've got to see how this mechanic works. So
right, and I think you and I are kind of similar in that, and in the negative space on that is if we read a rule set and we don't see any mechanical novelty or delight, we're like, nah, I don't need it, it's fine.
Yeah,
I understand how that game's going to work.
No, absolutely. And yeah, when I read a game and I think I've seen all of the mechanics before, I don't particularly see the point of like going through the sort of the effort putting the game together. So Melvin is the mechanical player. They are an appreciator of the craft of design. They are sort of the
and we mean game mechanic design there rather than anything else.
Yeah, they want to sort of they want to see what you did there. They want to see innovation and intent within a given mechanic. They want to see that the mechanic in the game is both new and that it has like a meaning and a path and a shape. And so it's not just pulling on a lever the way that maybe Timmy does because they just want to see the outcome of it. Melvin kind of wants to see pull the lever and then watch all the cogs turn and check that they interact in as satisfying and elegant a way as they imagined that they were going to. And it's like, so the in the terms of Magic the Gathering, the Melvin players are the people who want to see a new mechanic in each set of Magic cards, which they'll often do, you know, a new mechanic that does blah or whatever. And so say the Melvin player might never build a deck, but they want to see that new mechanic and then see how it interacts with all the old mechanics and consider that. And I think, as I say, for designing tabletop miniatures war games, you know, to hook them at you literal hooks, you know, not literal hooks, but the things that we literally call hooks, there you go, are there for your Melvin players, if nobody else. And the thing is, you can have a Johnny and a Timmy and a Spike, all of whom can be Melvin players. And these personality types cross over a lot more. But the hooks, the mechanical hooks on a game are there for catching your Melvins, for going
right. And I think, you know, this can apply now that I'm thinking about it in these terms, like this can apply to a model in like a, you know, in a skirmish game that has defined models, for example. Like, you know, you can imagine opening a new expansion, seeing a model and going, okay, well, that one kind of has a combat attack and has a shooting attack, and maybe it's got some keywords that are interesting, and we'll find out why that's interesting later. And then you find the model with the new mechanic that like interacts and allows you to do something different and break the rules in a new way. Spells are quite good for this as well. And so so like for the purposes of designing better miniature games, it's like at the very top level, it's like, is your game providing some mechanical crunch, some novel mechanical crunch that's going to allow Melvin to engage in the game in a way that they've never had to engage with a miniatures game before? Just a set of cogs that slot together in a different way. But then within the game, it's like, are you providing places where there's genuine novelty in like, well, everybody moves like this, except for this guy who moves like a crab, and you have to solve a different puzzle with this model.
Well, it's like, so I just recently, there's an unboxing that just popped up on the channel a couple of days ago of a game called Mars Code Aurora that one of our Discord members has had come out through Tomahawk.
One of your nicest thumbnail images, Glenn. You're really upping your game.
They made that cover. It was an easy one to thumbnail. Although I've been sort of considering, I've been trying to put a bit more into them. But sort of, you can see in the unboxing, I flip it over and I read on the back, and basically, I can't remember their exact wording, but basically on the back it says that it's a dice agnostic. It's use any sort of dice you like to play this game. And reading that sentence is to the Melvin player is like, I don't care what else the game does. I need to find out how you justify that claim. I've got to discover it. And it happens the book has a bunch of really interesting things in it. I might do a little review on the channel coming up. But that one sentence there is a perfect Melvin hook of a sentence where it's just like,
well, so like to blow your trumpet, like we were walking in the woods several years ago and I said, oh, were you working on a new game? And you went, yes, I'm working on a deck unbuilder. And I was like, right, ding 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 ding, you've got it, that's one. Like, Melvin's flock over here, please.
Yeah that made that an easy sell. And it's like, I think for me, one of the classic Melvin things was Malifaux and the fact that it's the way in which it's card driven. And as soon as I first encountered Malifaux, like, these are kind of cool models, it's kind of fun. It's like, it's deck driven and it's directed in this way. And it's like, okay, I'm doing it. I'm into this for the next couple of years. I don't care. I need to discover how this works. And so relating to like what you were saying about miniatures, so the last sort of category that Magic has, the player type, they call Vorthos. So Vorthos is the person who is in.
And I think it's both funny and appropriate, and they knew exactly what they were doing when they named that one with like a silly thematic name.
Yes. So Vorthos is the player who is interested in the background of the game, but specifically that the background of the game fits and works with the rules that you're introducing.
Right.
And so they split out between like the gamer version who wants to see that the rule hooks into the story and puppets it in the correct way, the artist who wants to see that the artwork on the Magic the Gathering card is being sort of supported by what that card then does. The writer who wants to know that the little bit of fluff underneath the rules sort of matches in with it. The oracle that they refer to is the person who's interested in the working the background with the wider community. They're the people who end up cosplaying. They like your game and they want to dress up as their character, and they want to know that the rule for the stick they're holding when they cosplay of your game makes the stick work the way that it feels like it should work when they're holding it. And the dreamer is the lore version of Vorthos, who wants to know that, oh yes, look, there's the rule for the something something, because in book 47 on page 942 they use the something something and it did exactly what that rule is saying it will do. That's a perfect rule for me.
And I think that there's at least one missing from that list from a miniatures war games perspective, because we have access to a sort of future historian who reads about an exciting event and then wants to go and explore that or replay it or whatever. Like there's a lot of like, I read about something cool in the background, and then I want to play a narrative campaign which explores those things, or I want to sling some scenarios together that retells that fictional history.
Absolutely. And I think kind of in a way obviously, but a lot of the roots of this sort of gaming being from sort of historical war games and our interest in simulationism is from people who want to refight, you know, the battle for Iwo Jima or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
You know, historical war gamers love refighting historical battles and seeing if they can change the outcome. And they both, you know, want the outcome to be really difficult to change, because of course it should be difficult to change because that's the way it happened in reality, but want it to be conceivably possible because they want to sort of, that's the fun of replaying the scenario. If it always came out the way it did in history, that would be uninteresting. And obviously, you know, one of the big things that's missing for a tabletop game experience are the miniatures.
I actually don't think that's Vorthos at all. I think there's a whole separate player persona type which is unavailable to a game like Magic the Gathering. And that's like some kind of physical cinematographer, where it's like, the thing that I want to do, the thing that's dragging me in, is that I can have a little, like, I can have a miniature world on my table, and I can tell stories. And I don't know whether it's directly related to the cinema of the mind element of it, but I certainly think, like, you know, I watch Esoteric Order of Gamers battle reports, because Peter over on that channel, he gets his camera down at the model's eye view, and then he gushes about how cool it looks and how cinematic. He's kind of framing up these like scenes from movies that are playing out on his table, and he's very careful to paint all of his terrain beautifully and all of his model beautifully. And I think that like physical cinematographer player persona type, who, that's the sort of player who's going to be attracted by the fact that there's like, wow, what can you do with this stuff? And then we'll take the time to make the experience beautiful, and we'll be, you know, more concerned about playing with fully painted models and terrain, and we'll want to create, you know, more elaborate setups, and we'll care about that spectacle.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right there, and I think it's something that for me tracks back to my first experience with Carnival, and sort of reading the original edition of Carnival, and it's like, oh, it's about wall running and getting into balconies and jumping up things, and then actually reading the rules and realizing you would never actually wall run in a million years. And now the new edition is sort of actually making it worth doing it. And I think that's very attractive to that sort of player, where it's like, it wants you to have a building with a balcony on it, because at some point somebody's going to jump off a balcony and do something and sort of pirouette around a, you know, awning and then land on the far side of the river. And it's interesting because I was reading a rule set from a new designer who sort of reached out to have me look over it. And it was a rule set about a flooded future, and that you were on these ruins that were like dotted around the seascape.
Drowned Earth.
No, I know that. Yes, obviously Drowned Earth. Yeah.
Another one.
I'm pretty sure it was another one, because it was sort of quite early in development. And sort of the point is that when I read that rule set, immediately what I wanted to do is jump off from top of one of the ruins and then dive down into the sea and pop up and jump onto my boat that was rowing past and go off, or swan dive off of the ruins and then backflip and land on the boat or on the bottom. And there were no rules that let me do that. And it's like, okay, you've got to speak to the cinematography of those moments for people. If I look at your table and instantly want to do a particular moment, a particular piece of cinematography, you've got to give me that. You've got to justify me putting a balcony up, you know?
I think that's really interesting. I think I think there are elements there of like, it's slightly separate to what I was going for, and I think it's equally valuable, which is that like making the cinematic action, making that theatre of the mind work in the way that player wants. Because I mean, I was thinking almost more just like almost more inert than that. It's like, allow me to create the images. Like an example of where this needs to be supported by your game is if terrain rules are written badly, it can be possible that terrain is really awkward. And the more terrain you put on the board, the more the game kind of sort of fights you and, you know, it stops working or it provides bizarre advantages. And I guess to sort of get closer to where you're going, like making winning look good, making winning look cool, like if you're trying to create a certain kind of visual for the game, but the right way to win is to play in a more, you know, obscured or defensive, or never to like put your model in the cool looking place, like you want to be able to have those images also be potentially part of, you know, looking cool and winning. Can
I mean, I think it's not just winning, but sort of there being a reason of having done it. It's like the sort of the classic parody of superhero movies is the superhero stands up on top of a building, says a line, and then goes, "I don't know what I came up here for," and then has to like clamber back down again. And it's the thing of if at some point one of my miniatures is meant to end up on a balcony, don't make me wonder when I get up there. Why did I come up here? What was the point of this? Don't put down terrain and then have me walk into the middle of the train and go, that was dumb of me. Why on earth did I do that? I'll never walk into terrain ever again. You know, and it doesn't have to be like...
Right. One of the cardinal sins, and something that I'm working on in a rough draft design at the moment, is in a lot of skirmish games, people's mind... If you're a certain kind of gamer, like Necromunda casts a long shadow, and Necromunda had very three-dimensional terrain, and yet models in that game moved very slowly. And so actually navigating a complex, even 3x3, three-dimensional area, you just didn't have enough time, and it was really slow and bizarre. So like simple things like how fast are your models moving? Are they enabling the sort of like cinema that you're imagining? And are they actually enabling, like if you tell me with your photography in your rule book that it should be cool to have multi-level things, and then you don't give me like a way of getting up and down levels other than via ladders, then now I have to model ladders everywhere and it doesn't, you know, necessarily, that's not what I want to do. So it's like you've got to meet this player, this physical cinematographer, halfway and say, I want you to have a cool looking experience, and so I'm going to try and make sure that I remove the lumps that would get in the way of your cool looking table also being a viable game experience. Because if I play a game with my cool terrain that I've taken ages playing and it doesn't really work, then I'll go find another game that is better delivering the experience that I want, both from a mechanical point of view and a physical cinematography point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very interesting game sort of being developed right now on the Discord called Enthrall, which is gives you the ability to keep moving, provided you're doing like movements referred to as traversing, which are essentially climbing, jumping, going through difficult terrain. And if you're not doing any of those things, then you basically have to stop when you change over. So like if you can hit a wall and run up it and then run along the wall and then jump off of it and then run through some difficult terrain, you can keep moving. And then soon as you go into open space again, you're like, oh, all right, okay, I've sort of run out of steam.
And he's right, like, it's like when the drum beat is going really hard and then they like run out into the open, it goes ba-ba-bum.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly silent, and you're like, shit, I got caught in the open.
Yeah, you see, yeah, it's really interesting. He's sort of, the designer's working through it in a very interesting way, and I'm not sort of, you know, a few times I've been like, I don't get this and I don't get that, but I love what he's doing with it, and it's really sort of interesting, exciting. And I think it's like, it's grabbing those sorts of things you're talking about here. So working out ways to say, why should I bother putting down that kind of tabletop down? Why should I bother trying to do these things? And it's trying to say to your players, okay, this is why you should have built this incredible sort of sculpted tabletop. And this is why the tabletop is going to be part of the experience.
Now, because we're both Melvins and we're excited by a new mechanic that we discovered, and you're a Johnny and we're excited by inventing a new creative expression in that new personality type, I think we perhaps skipped over Vorthos a little bit, because like there's a couple of obvious things to say about Vorthos. Like Vorthos gets annoyed when the stories have a scene where the thing happens, or the model or the like character does something cool, or the tank blows up a thing, and then they try and replicate that in the game and it just doesn't work. Or they put the things together and the mechanics just feel completely wrong compared to what they were being told. Or they are told by the story and the lore to build an army in a certain way, and it turns out if you just build this really ugly looking unthematic army, it performs much better on the table.
Absolutely. And I've talked about it a few times on the channel, but the first edition Malifaux version of Seamus for me was the most pure sort of expression of a Vorthos moment for me personally, where Seamus in that first edition played exactly the way his lore said, and the most powerful way of playing him was in his lore way. And it happens to be a way that worked very well for me because I'm a tactical and less strategic player, and you know, he plays better if there's more chaos on the tabletop, which is what I react to quite well when I'm playing a game. And so that was just like, that was just such a perfect moment. It was the perfect crew for me. And every single game, it's like, this is exactly what the book said he was going to do. This is exactly where it said he was going to excel. This is so incredibly satisfying. I love it so very much.
Right. And I think, like, it's quite a small example, but like Adeptus Titanicus does this really good job of, because the weapons have these really distinct roles, like low strength, high attacks are completely different roles in the game mechanics to high strength, low attacks, which are, you know, one's for stripping shields and the other's for blowing chunks of armor off. And like, that is very clearly described in the way that, like, you know, they're talking about these hails of fire and the fields are going and they're dying, and then it's stomping forwards and then finally like a massive machine. And so I think there's a really good coherence between a clear statement of what the purpose of individual elements in the game's sort of in-world universe are for, and then mechanically they just operate correctly to the sort of stated purpose of them. But I'm sure everyone has got their favorite unthematic annoying army list that they're like, that they've either faced or begrudgingly written and then maybe purchased the models for or discarded as like, well, I'm not fielding that. That's just meh.
We'll be back in just a second.
Absolutely. So I think you wanted to have a little chat about some more classically video game based personality types before we sign off on this. You were talking about Bartles, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a classic like quad diagram, and the two axes are 2x2, and the two axes are, is the player more or less interested in acting or interacting and are they interested in the other axes, is are they interested in acting on the player or acting on the world? And so that gives you these four quadrants of like, people who want to act directly on other players are called the killers and they're looking to frag everyone. People who want to act on the world or the sort of game, the game itself, they're achievers who are trying to like unlock all the things, find all the locations, trigger all the special achievements and upgrades and whatnot. And then there's, on the interacting side, there's people who are interacting with the players, and so they're less about fragging each other and more about just socializing. So how can I use this game to socialize? And then the last quadrant is the explorer, which you mentioned at the beginning of the first part of this conversation, is something that's maybe harder to achieve in a tabletop game, which is someone who's interested in interacting with the world, uncovering the world, literally exploring the world. And I think that as we're talking about some of the player personality types, I think that like the players who want to explore new mechanics and see more of the life of the world come to life, like I think there is an element of exploration in a larger tabletop game that offers a lot of expansive things you can experience. And even in a small indie game, which is providing you with what's the word I'm looking for? Like incentives to sort of try different things. Mm. That can, I think, break into this interacting with the world side of this quadrant, where the explorer is looking to just sort of see everything and feel everything and kind of wring the most sort of variety of flavors out of this game. Whereas the achiever, I think, is someone who's really interested in, you know, playing all the factions, putting each of the models on the table to see what they can do, you know, playing all of the scenarios to see which ones are more or less interesting to them. Like it's very common to meet a player who's extremely obsessed with one faction and is becoming very, very expert in that faction. And then on the same evening, meet someone who is, you know, basically got a little smattering of everything and has played every faction and doesn't really have a particular favorite, because their favorite is all of them and the experience of all of them.
I mean, it's interesting, I think, in relation to the Achiever. I'm not sure whether you can sort of hit the Explorer note sort of quite right in a tabletop game, just simply because the players are piloting the game, and so right. they can't hide anything from them. But I definitely think you can do the Achiever thing. I think it's interesting because Gaslands has a little set of achievements. You've got it on the website. You sort of pulled it out of the tournament once. And there's a game called Hostage Negotiator. It's a solo game. It's a boxed board game. But that has like a set of terrorists you've got to sort of negotiate with. And it has a set of achievements where if you win the scenario by doing X, you tick that achievement. And it's an idea I've sort of borrowed myself for some of my games. It's entirely achievable to say, okay, if you play faction X and you do this during a game, you can tick off this achievement. You can literally give people a bit of paper with some tick boxes, and you can say, if you manage to, whatever, win a game with only snotlings, you get to tick this box. If you get mm-hmm. to do this. And that's entirely achievable, and it totally, you know, fulfills what that achiever personality type in video games is looking for. And it's, you know, it's something you can totally do in like a page on in your game rules. And I don't really know why more sort of physical tabletop games don't do it, because it's still satisfying.
Well, I think buried inside it, and I don't know kind of the tangled origin really is, but like, I think one of the reasons that people always ask for campaign systems in war games is, I think, a little bit to do with this, which is they want a reason to come back and like check off the next thing, whether it's like a very simple thing of like, how many games did we play? But they don't feel very good unless there's some kind of experience, because I want to be collecting something and kind of getting, you know, being able to say, oh yeah, I got my wizard to level 10 and that was great. Or, you know, my gang had to, you know, had to retire because it had got, you know, 40,000 XP and, you know, that was the end of that. But I achieved that. I have, you know, have you ever got a gang to retire? Oh, yeah, I had to. Yeah, I've had three gangs retire, actually. That's how much I've played of this game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's obviously a sort of a collector mentality where, you know, if you give somebody a list of tick boxes, everybody wants to tick them off. And we mentioned Arkham Horror earlier. Arkham Horror has achievement boxes for ticking off if you win a scenario in a particular way or have a particular character use a particular item. So, you know, these do...
Yeah, and I guess I think it's also just, it's worth thinking about it in more abstract terms rather than specifically ticking off achievements, which I think is good and underused. But I think, like, thinking about what discrete moments you are providing to the player where you pat them on the head and say, you did a thing.
Go on.
And I'm not completely sure about how to achieve this, but that's kind of why I wanted to shine a little torch at it.
I think the thing is, and I think it's probably where sort of achievements in computer games probably came from. It's from those people who were doing it without being told to be doing it. You know, it's that those photographs you see from the 80s of someone stood next to the screen with a particular like high score on the screen or whatever else to show that they did the achievement, and the video games have sort of simply codified that. I think it's one of the things that's probably worth saying about all of these personality types is that the most hardcore versions of these personality types will wring what they want out of your game, like,
right, regardless,
kicking or screaming,
right. And like for achievers, where achieving is social status, which is one element of this personality type, then like Spike and Johnny are already doing this day in, day out by going to tournaments, and tournaments provide, like, any game that's got a ranking system is there to provide, you know, social proof of achievements achieved.
Yeah, and it's like when you say, you know, people say, oh, did you retire a gang? Did you do this? Did you do the other? It's like the achievers will find a thing to ask people, well, did you do this? Did you win with that thing? Did you use that unit?
Right.
Whereas I think, like, my point would be that the hardcore achievers are going to make up their own achievements. They do it walking around their house, you know what I mean? What you're trying to do is like give a little something to the second tier people who aren't super, you know, obsessed with finding achievements and creating them. But if you give them a little list, if you'd say, have you considered trying to do X or Y? They'll go, I hadn't, but now you've put the idea in my head.
We're oddly for the first time in a channel that talks about miniature games design, we're talking about gamification, but not the gamification that is the thing that we normally do.
No, true. Yeah. The game.
So on the acting on other players, I think for me, acting on other players is about that. Like, it's about that direct competitive interaction with another player. And we've already talked about a couple of player personality types who are an expression of this. But I think that this is this is a useful distinction between people who care about people who care about interacting with players because it's an interesting test of strength, test of wills, test of wits, versus people who just want to wring the most enjoyment out of the person sitting on the other side from a social perspective. They're kind of more interested in entertaining that other people and extracting entertainment from them on some kind of different level. They want to interact with that person, not necessarily mediated through the game in the same way, but clearly mediated in some way through the game, because otherwise we wouldn't put these games between us.
I mean, I think the thing is that's interesting about tabletop games versus video games, and particularly in relation to this, is that, you know, there is an idea for a video game to say, hey, you might make a video game that involves two people playing against each other, as opposed to a one-player video game, because a lot of video games are one player, and certainly historically enormous amount were. Whereas sort of asking that question of tabletop game is kind of like, eh? And then again with a video game, you go, oh, by the way, when you get people to like play against each other, you might want to let them be able to talk to each other while they're doing it, and maybe give them like time to interact with each other aside from playing the game. Whereas when you're both stood opposite each other at a tabletop, the idea of the game going, why not allow people the right to talk to each other while they're doing it about things other than the game, feels a bit like what you do.
No, but at the same time, what miniature war games design is very blind on is collaboration and sort of letting people help each other out. And sure, there are collaborative games. They're mostly board games, but like this whole medium right now is sort of set up by default to be a kind of, you know, the top quadrant where you're killing each other. Whereas like the classic example here is like some kind of Farmville thing where like I can be playing the game and then you can pop by and help out for a bit and then pop off again. And that kind of like constructive and collaborative, cooperative gameplay, it's just really hard. We have historically found it very hard to achieve.
Although it has to be said, it's like, again, if you were designing a multiplayer game like Gaslands, where you have a rock paper scissor relationship between some of the sort of abilities, where, you know, I need you to take care of him because I can't take care of him and I'm going to lose if he doesn't get taken care of, there can be a collaborative element to competitive gaming. I think it's like it's hard to make cooperative tabletop games. Although that said, you know, there is a lovely Discord server of non-combat tabletop games that a lot of them are about collaborative play. I'm working on a cooperative miniatures game. It's not beyond conception. And obviously there are like things like Relic Blade, where you can all, you know, play for a dungeon together side by side, and obviously you're collaborating to some degree on that.
I think this is one of the reasons why, and I've rabbited on about this in a previous video, but I'll briefly mention again, like this is one of the reasons why I think that considering specifically tabletop miniature games designs purely on their game component of the experience is sort of missing some of the point. And so I've talked about this hobby game loop where like there's a sort of mental preparation stage where you're thinking about the game, there's a physical preparation stage where you know in a solitary manner are preparing the physical materials that you need, the terrain and the models, then you're playing the game, and then you're digesting and analyzing the experience ready to go back around that loop again. And to a degree, like a lot of the sort of Farmville popping along and helping me out elements of miniature games design are what we do in WhatsApp all day long when we're sending, like, you know, screenshots of like paint schemes that we've seen on Instagram to each other, and we're like, you know, what are you working on? Well, let's challenge each other to try and finish that, and like, oh, have you thought about doing this, or like blah blah blah. Like, there's so much of a social aspect to miniature games which are kind of outside of what's written in the rule book. But like, successfully executing a miniature game to any kind of success requires an understanding of the community that's going to hopefully build and then flourish around your game. And like, honestly, I lucked out on this with Gaslands, with the car converting thing, which has ended up being like a very important part of like the player interacting outside of the game on a social element. And, you know, the sort of like, the serendipitous discovery of new miniatures to use in Gaslands, like all of this stuff is incredibly powerful for the hobby game loop for Gaslands. It's just that some of that I accidentally stumbled into without really understanding that's what I was going to do. But I think that like, it's worth thinking about, like, in your game, how are you going to provide rationales and reasons and motivators for this kind of conversation to happen?
Yeah, I really strongly think that this is one of these sort of areas that we keep coming back to and sort of stumbling around and trying to figure out where the line between the mechanics of a miniatures game and the physical hobby nature of a miniatures game, and the social aspect of the game, and what defines it, and what to what degree, and what we're interested in talking about in any moment. And yeah, and I think it's possibly why there isn't such an attempt to split down some of these personality types, you know, in this part of the hobby, because it's incredibly hard to split out, you know, the people who play the game for the mechanics and the game, the people who are playing the game for the hobby aspects, and the vast majority of people who are a mix of the two. You know, they play miniatures.
Yeah, because I bet you mentioned this right at the beginning of the first of these two conversations, but you were like, here's a set of player personality types that Magic the Gathering has. I bet that Games Workshop has some, but they haven't published any. But at the same time, like, I bet you, like, one of the core customer types for Games Workshop is a person who just buys the models to paint them, and they talk about that customer type publicly in their year end, you know, public reports. Like, those customer types, they are sort of physical cinematographers, they are crafters, they are people who are very likely engaging in a social. Even though it's a solitary activity, they're engaging in a community and social element around it. And it's like, to your point, like, achieving success in a miniature game design, like, to what element can you remove the miniatures from that by not making the miniatures and making a miniature agnostic game and just making a game? Like, how much do you lose? Or do you just lose access to a customer type that sort of was only tangentially related to miniature games design in the first place, because they are figurine painters?
I suppose that the question has to be, it's like, to what degree do the GW games designers care or think about that part of the customer base? Is there any crossover where they go, well, you know, we should design this thing, or we should name this thing to appeal to those people?
Well, I think Vorthos, I think Vorthos probably exists on both sides of the plays games divide, where, you know, there are definitely players, there are definitely customers who read Horus Heresy novels and then drop, you know, $180 on a massive slug of resin for one of the Primarchs or whatever. And the reason that they've done that is because they like the image of that model evokes the right, you know, there's even a couple models that like engage in a duel that's from the story and stuff. So like, I bet you that there is, you know, enough engagement in that IP that there's a what's the opposite of dissonance?
Resonance.
Yeah, where the resonance between the setting and the stories and the lore and the miniatures works, they're like, brilliant, I want that. Whereas miniatures that maybe look cool but haven't really featured anywhere and don't really mean anything in the lore, like some funny little chaos engine of war that's only ever been mentioned in one battle scene, like maybe those things just don't get picked up by those customers. It's like, well, that's like one of the like Clone Wars ships that's only on screen for a second in some obscure Star Wars spin-off thing, and like, I don't care about that object. It's not interesting to me because it's not, you know, the thing that the main character flew. So I don't know. Yeah. We're kind of slightly off base here, but it's like, I guess the point I was trying to make is there is a vast, to me it feels like there's a vast wealth of potential thinking and drawing from these player personas, and we've cut them up using the Magic the Gathering ones, and we've cut them up using the video game ones. We've identified maybe some ones that are unique for miniature games. And then on top of that, you've got like, what is your game? What is your product trying to sell? And which of these can you access, and by what methods and what parts of your product can you access them and activate those parts of their brains? And of course, to underline what I said at the end of the last video, which is these are not individual humans. These are components of humans. And each of us are many of these persona types all mixed up together. And more so with one game or another.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to sort of to round the conversation off, I would say that's for me here the most important idea about these personality types is that they are shared by, you know, most of us are a bit of all of them. You can feed all of those parts in people within your rules. You can speak to somebody who cares primarily about making a physical miniature in the rules you write. You can tell them why it matters. You know, WYSIWYG is a classic rule that speaks to those people and says it does matter whether you model a sword or a spear on that particular miniature. It does matter whether you like sculpt on a cloak to be his magical cloak. You'll be even more correctly sort of sticking to WYSIWYG rules. And we can reach out to them by saying like, okay, here's a campaign rule that asks you to re-sculpt things or change things as they move along. You know, whether or not they ever physically play the game, we can always inspire them by saying, you know, maybe even if I haven't made a miniature, this is what the miniature that would exist for this character might be like, might act like, and the things they might be carrying. Now you can go forth and source those things and sculpt those things and paint them in a cool way and pose them in the way that I said that they might stand, and you'll understand why they would stand that way because I've said what they do in the game. And you know, they all feed back and forth, and I really think that the number of, you know, customers, gamers, whatever they are, who are one of these things and only one of these things and only ever one of these things is a vanishingly small number. I mean, the professional miniature painters who have never ever played a game might sort of loom large because they have obviously quite big followings, you know, because of the nature of like the visual mediums that we all work in. But I think if there are any who literally have never even read the rule book, there are a tiny number of people. I think by and large, it's all an ecosystem, and considering how they back and forth and how one loop gets a player back to your game and then feeds into the other loop and feeds into the other loop, you know, the person who plays one of the sponsors in Gaslands and makes a team for it and then wants to make another team and then play that sponsor and then wants to, you know, it's all part of the same wheel and it's all part of the same balance. And the more you can attract them to a different bit of your game with a miniature, the longer you'll get them to play the game, and the more you can track to another bit with the lore and another bit with the rule, you'll get them coming back to the game again and again and again and feeding into it and supporting the community and attracting other people. If you can convince them it's worth painting a really cool mini, then when they go to their clubs, there's a higher chance of a new person picking up your game when they see that really cool mini and go, well, what game is that for? I want to know about it. I think that we will sign off on this conversation. I think it's been fascinating. I think it's really interesting that, you know, there aren't these categories for this sort of game. And I really do want to sort of consider what would be the equivalents and how they would break down from the new unique feature of these games. And if you also would like to consider those things, please put yourself into the comment section and tell me about what you think one of the equivalents would be for a tabletop miniatures war game. Swing by the Discord and tell me about it there again, because I can never hear these things too often. when you're doing the comment, please punch the like and subscribe buttons. It's a happy thing and makes me giggle. But for now and till next time, I think we'll be signing off in this episode of Rule of Carnage. So thank you and goodbye.
Sounds good. It's been great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.